Interior, a Pennsylvania nightclub sometime in the late 1980s.
Hey ladies, welcome to the glam metal capital of the fucking world!
What are you talking about, Studley dude?
Glam metal? I wish. This ain't the Sunset Strip.
Ladies, come on! We're not talking the first wave of glam metal here. We're in Pennsylvania, goddamnvania! New school, home of Cinderella, the ancestral home of Mother Frickin' Poison. Just hop across the Delaware River, my lovelies, and you've got yourself some Bon Jovi and Skid Row. This is where it's at.
Ooh, yeah. What do you think, Brandy? Is this guy right?
He sure is, Trixie. You know what, hon? I don't think there is anything sexier on this earth than a man who can teach us all about...
Heavy Metal! What a one!
John! My bosom buddy! My old pal! Friend o' mine! I know that we have had our differences in the past. However, surely we can both agree that there is nothing sexier on this earth than a man who can teach everybody all about heavy metal. No? Hey, wait, I'm gonna change that. I'm gonna make it not sexist. I'm gonna start over. One more time. John! My bosom buddy. My old pal. Friend o' mine. I know that we have had our differences in the past. However, surely we can both agree that there is indeed nothing sexier on this earth than a man, or a woman, who can teach everybody all about heavy metal. No?
I feel like this whole episode is just... already in the first half page, primed for you to try and get me to compliment you, and it's not gonna happen.
This is the time, John, where you cast your flowers upon me, you laud my scholarly brilliance, my physical beauty, and I feel like everyone will be better off for it.
I feel like maybe you have become a little bit delusional as to the classroom dynamic these days.
It's probably fair. I think that's why HR has been on my back.
As an in-character student, I'm supposed to be sleeping right now.
Well, I suppose that's probably fair based on my own experiences as an in-classroom teacher. Well, anyhow, hallowed be his name, righteous scholar of metal. You know, beloved HM101 acolytes, today truly is a great day, a magical day, a beautiful day. Today is the day where John and I once more don our leather and lace, apply an appropriately thick coating of glamorous makeup, and continue our vast, extensive explorations into the sordid, wonderful history of one of America's greatest artistic exports, glam metal. And on that note, John, might I say you're looking quite fetching in the particular combination of leather, lace, and glamorous makeup you're wearing for today's recording session.
Thank you. I worked very hard on it.
See, I complimented you. Was that hard? It didn't feel hard, but you got nothing. You just take the compliment, and you sit there in stony silence.
I'm a taker.
Yes, you are. Now look, I truly do understand that glam metal is not a universally beloved heavy metal subgenre in this day and age. I get that this music has long since been disowned by many of my fellow heavy metal cognoscenti. But not me, John. Not me. Do you respect my dogged tenacity, intellectual integrity, and rugged dedication to this cause?
You know what? I have to say, I feel like this is where, in some sort of weird way, you and I are aligned.
Ooh.
In that I piss off all our listeners by saying all this music sucks, and you piss off all our listeners by saying that glam metal is heavy metal.
It's actually completely true. It is on episodes like today that we manage to collectively piss off everybody.
Huzzah!
I told you it was going to be a great day. I feel excellent. All right. Well, look, it's okay. I don't do this for you, John.
I know.
I do it for the children. For the children! Look, let's reach deep into the murky waters of the past and try to see what lurked just below the surface of that great and glorious second wave of glam metal.
Yes.
Now, contrary to popular belief, I don't actually set out trying to create podcast scripts that are 400 pages long. Sometimes it just happens. You're willing to testify to that, right?
Genuinely, yes. It is terrifying. And these are single-spaced.
And in a small font. I wonder how many words I've written for Heavy Metal 101.
More than you're going to write for your dissertation, I'll tell you that.
I think that's true. Maybe I'll just collect my scripts and turn that in as a dissertation.
Oh, I bet that'd go well.
I think so, too. All right. Well, look, I just want you to know I'm going to do my very damnedest to ensure that that does not happen for this episode. I think, John, that we can work together and try to be that lean, mean HM101 machine that I know we're capable of being. What do you think?
I will keep my comments to a minimum.
All right. You just be terse and maybe a little cruel, and I think we'll get through this thing.
Easy.
Aces. My goal here today is to explore the period of glam metal's greatest ascendancy into the larger popular culture, which is often known as its second wave. This was a period lasting roughly between 1986 through 1991, at which point some band called Nirvana released some tune called Smells Like Teen Spirit, and apparently suddenly glam metal wasn't so much the beloved icon of American culture it had once been. John, are you familiar with that band, that song?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
I mean, I've heard of Nirvana. I have heard the song Smells Like Teen Spirit.
It sounds intriguing to me. I'll have to check it out. Now, in keeping with our season 3 theme, we're really going to focus only on the 1980s portion of that swath of time, cutting things off for now after 1989. John, you get what we're up to today? Second wave glam metal, 1986 to 1989, hookers, blow, good?
We're going to talk about 3 years of not at all heavy music. Got it. Let's go.
And hookers.
Sure.
All right. We're going to attempt to cover quite a few bands reasonably efficiently. In part, we're going to do this by framing the discussion into larger categories, an academic technique that I think you'll appreciate. This will allow us to get a general overview of the lay of the land in pop and glam metal circles in this period, and to then more deeply investigate just a few of those particularly essential artists who emerged in the second wave and grew to become among the heaviest hitters of the era. John, we've got structures, and you love a good structure, right?
I do love structure.
I do this for you. That having been said, are you ready for category numero uno?
Let's get into it.
All right. Please read out the category name for the nice people.
Category one, the breakout pop metal masterpieces of 1986 and 87.
We begin with the nationalization and internationalization of glam-esque glory that occurred at the outset of the second wave. Which, of course, brings us right back to our old friends, Bon Jovi, who we already discussed at great length. In fact, I'd call our entire classic episode, Metal Gets Huge, three pop metal masterpieces from 1986/87, utterly indispensable background for this very episode. So go listen to that, and you'll basically have covered most of category number one. John, they should go listen to that, right?
Sure.
It's a good one. Very informative. Since we've already covered that material, I'm not going to go into any real detail, but I want to clearly state that the glam-informed pop metal masterpieces of the years 1986 and 1987, most especially Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet, but also Whitesnake's self-titled album and Def Leppard's Hysteria, all played an enormous role in the ascension of glam metal in these years. These albums also helped to expand the geographical footprint of this music, which in its first wave was relegated primarily to Los Angeles' Sunset Strip. Suddenly, we had glam metal-adjacent music emerging from such far-flung places as Sayreville, New Jersey, Sheffield, England, and whatever vast assortment of exotic locales the ginormous collective of people who worked with Whitesnake around this time hailed from. But we already covered those three albums. Go us! Before completely moving on, however, I would like to add just one more essential glam-adjacent pop metal masterpiece to our category number one roll call. A truly outstanding collection of glammy pop metal tunes from 1986 that we have not previously mentioned on this show. John, any ideas?
No.
Well, surprise, surprise. John, that would be Europe with their seminal masterpiece, The Final Countdown. John, are you familiar with Europe, not merely as a continent, but also as a world-beating Swedish pop metal band?
I literally only know the Final Countdown. I could not even begin to name another piece of music by that band.
But you do, of course, know particularly the opening keyboard riff, the Titanic title track, the beautiful, beautiful hit single that is The Final Countdown.
I mean, I think genuinely you would be hard-pressed to find someone in today's culture who wouldn't at least recognize that music, even if they didn't know who what it was or who it was by.
My girls, who are 11, sing along with it when it comes on the radio. So, yeah, it has definitely transcended its way from pop metal into universal cultural artifact. I mean, I think it's fair to say that The Final Countdown is probably a bit on the overplayed side, but I do think that that song, as well as the entire album that surrounds it, are all pretty dang fantastic. The Final Countdown didn't do quite the business of, say, a Slippery When Wet, but it did peak at number 8 on the US charts and was certified triple platinum here. Importantly, it also helped spread the glam gospel throughout, unsurprisingly, the continent of Europe. It hit number 1 in Sweden, Switzerland, Spain, and Finland, and was a top 10 smash all across the globe. Now, Europe, like Bon Jovi, never really fit 100% comfortably alongside the truer, bluer glam metal acts, but their brand of pretty hair, pretty faces, and accessible pop metal certainly helped open the floodgates for the utter international chart domination of glam metal's second wave. John, are you sad you weren't yet born into a beautiful world which worshipped at the altar of all that was glammy and occasionally very, very mildly satanic?
No.
You're okay with it?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. It's good to be comfortable in your own skin. I think that's important. All right. So we've kicked down the doors via Bon Jovi, Europe, Whitesnake, and Def Leppard, four glam-adjacent pop metal bands who had huge albums in 1986 and 1987. Now we're going to deepen this story by looking in on how some classic metal artists, all of whom we have previously discussed here on HM101, spent the second wave period embracing this idiom in their own varied assortment of ways. Welcome to category number 2, everybody. John, read it!
Category 2. When classic HM101 faves embraced their glam metal muse.
Yes! 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 John, you know these bands. They're some of our oldest friends here on HM101. As such, why don't you tell us a bit about what this talented collection of classic metal artists were getting up to in the glam metal trenches of the late 1980s? That would be ever so nice.
Well, Eric, I'd be happy to talk about some of our old pals from episodes past. For instance, did you know that both Van Halen, newly led by former Montrose singer Sammy Hagar, and the now former Van Halen frontman David Lee Roth, both released very glamish pop metal masterpieces in the year 1986?
Whoa, there, good buddy! Well, I am more than willing to admit that David Lee Roth's brilliant Enum and Smile, which brought together one of the more impressive collection of shredders in all of metal history as his backing band, is indeed a certified goddamn masterpiece. I'm not sure I'm quite as comfortable putting the somewhat mawkish 5150 by Van Hagar into that category. And to be clear, I generally actually do like Hagar-led Van Halen just fine.
You're the expert, buddy, and also probably the smartest human being I've ever met.
Oh, John, the things you say off of the cuff. I'm blushing. Anyhow, you're probably wondering just who that magnificent collection of shredders who were working with David Lee Roth at this time were, no?
Why would I be wondering that, Eric? I'm the one who brought it up in the first place. I clearly already know everything about this.
Don't fuck up the script, John. This band, which metaphorically was basically like David Lee Roth being accompanied by three Eddie Van Halens, consisted of Steve Vai, guitar, Billy Sheehan, bass, and Greg Bissonette, drum. Holy fuckballs, was that ever a great band? And they made a great album. Just one. We don't need to talk about Skyscraper. But John, were there, perhaps, other HM101-approved artists also dabbling in the making of glam metal-informed music at this time?
Of course there were, Eric. Why, even Ozzy Osbourne was getting in on the glam via his highly polished album, The Ultimate Sin, which was his final work with guitarist Jake E. Lee.
Incidentally, it was around this time that we get the legendary story of Ozzy, poolside at a hotel while on tour with Motley Crue, first lapping up a puddle of his own urine from the ground, then snorting a line of ants directly up his nose, and then lapping up a puddle of Nikki Sixx's urine off the ground. That scamp. Okay, please, continue.
That's disgusting.
It's It's not the least disgusting Ozzy Osbourne story, I will say that.
Anywho, if Ozzy Goes Glam wasn't crazy enough, even that most beloved of traditional metal institutions, the mighty Judas Priest.
Judas Priest?
Yes, Judas Priest, were getting in on the fun with their somewhat controversial glam metal release, Turbo.
Now, for the record, Turbo Lover is one of my favorite fucking Priest songs. I love it. But that having been said, glam and Judas Priest weren't a particularly natural fit. And Turbo is a pretty weird outlier amongst the larger Priest catalog. There were, however, three other classic 70s artists who proved to be quite a bit more successful with their own glam dabblings in this period. John, do you have any idea who I might be talking about?
Well, Eric, I can only assume that one of the first things to spring to your mind would be Kiss.
Yes, indeedy. We've already talked at length about Kiss's extremely poppy Crazy Nights album just two episodes back, but I will note here and now that Kiss did about as good a job as any of the middle-aged metal bands in navigating the youth-centric waters of the glam metal movement. That said, probably the most commercially successful glam-adjacent comeback for arguably a traditional metal band would be Aerosmith's utterly delightful Permanent Vacation, which did an amazing job of synthesizing elements of the band's classic blues rock aesthetic alongside cutting-edge, highly accessible glam/pop metal elements. It sold over 5 million copies in the US alone and brought a rather moribund band back into the hallowed halls of superstardom. So that's pretty impressive, right?
Sure.
Your enthusiasm, as always, is an inspiration to us all. Hell, even Alice Cooper got in on the fun. His 1986 comeback album, Constrictor, was a mix of a particularly macabre strain of glam and pop metal, alongside some amount of lingering new wave left over from his earlier 80s work. I'm more inclined to call his 1987 release, Raise Your Fist and Yell, traditional metal. But Cooper finally did go unambiguously full-on glam via his 1989 late-period breakthrough, Trash. John, are you an 80s Coop fan?
You know I have not listened to a single bit of 80s Coop.
Lies! Because I wanted you to experience some of the best of old artists dabbling in glam waters. So on your playlist, I included the song Poison, which is the lead-off track from the album Trash. Do you remember that song?
3 hours later.
I think when I was listening to that, I thought this was the band Poison and not the song Poison.
No.
Either way, I hated it.
Oh, no! Really?
Yeah.
God, I fucking love that song so much.
I believe my one comment to you in advance of this recording was Poison sucks.
It's true. And I assumed you were talking about the band, but it seems like you were possibly talking about the band and the song, kind of confounding them together.
Hey, listen, it's easy to generalize.
You know what sucks, John? You sucks. You sucks.
Aw, thank you.
Look, I fucking love all three of those Alice Cooper albums, and I very clearly recall the day when I officially declared Alice Cooper as my second favorite artist after Kiss, which was not long after Trash was released.
You heard it here, folks. Eric loves Trash.
I do. Oh my gosh, I set you up for that one. That was good. This particular tune, Poison, was penned by Cooper, guitarist John McMurray, and our good old friend, song doctor Desmond Child. But you didn't like it at all? You thought it was trash?
I mean, it's fine. It didn't do anything. It's not like it's a bad... None of the music you made me listen to for this was bad.
Okay.
I mean, it's glammy. It's pop. It doesn't feel like what I think of when you say heavy metal, and none of it feels particularly like... Oh, wow, they did something really cool there. It just sort of feels kind of formulaic and kind of similar.
What's it like to be dead inside, John?
You know, life's pretty easy.
I could see that. Fair enough, fair enough. Look, glam in this period really was one of those rising tides that brought a whole bunch of boats along for the ride, and I don't think any of the above bands going glamish seems all that crazy. That said, hard as it may be to believe, glam was so cool at this point that some bands, who, at least on the surface, would appear to have stood for everything that glam is not, also decided to experiment with dipping an artistic toe into glammy waters. Which now brings us to category number three. John?
Category number three. completely fucking weird entries into the second wave glam metal canon.
Ooh, this is gonna be fun. You ready to get fucking weird?
Well, maybe it'll be fun.
Of course, I didn't put any of these on your playlist because they're all like really hard to find and fucking weird.
Oh, so you left out all the potentially interesting music. Got it.
I think that's actually accurate. Yes. Do you perchance recall our brief prior discussion about the legendary English hardcore band Discharge and their profound formative influence on the American thrash metal movement?
No, but I bet I made some sort of comment to the effect of I don't like that band name.
I could see you not liking that band name, but I think you were too busy reading scripted stuff at the time, so you probably didn't get to get that in.
No room for independent thought.
Now we have record of your disapproval of the name Discharge.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Discharge.
Stop it.
Well, Discharge formed in 1977, and not only did they influence the development of a whole bunch of other genres, including particularly American thrash metal, but they also created a genre all their own, D-beat. So that's pretty impressive, no?
What is it?
It's just a kind of punk, a kind of crust punk that has very politically charged themes. There's a specific drum beat associated with it, but suffice to say, a lot of bands played in a genre that they identified as having been created by and influenced by Discharge, so they get D-beat. I don't think you'd be able to discern it from any other kind of, like, just hardcore music, but it exists. People accept it.
Okay. All right.
And yet, for reasons which must be kept between them and their ghastly, freakish god figure... In 1986, Discharge released Grave New World, an album on which they exchanged their signature leftist anarcho hardcore punk for, wait for it, a glam metal leaning, fairly mainstream heavy metal sound. Sort of. Ish. Legend has it that the band had recently rediscovered a love for Led Zeppelin, and it was this particularly which was responsible for vocalist Kelvin Cal Morrison switching from his punk-style barking to a shrill falsetto dirty glam vocal approach on Grave New World. John, could anything in the world be more interesting than the idea of a universally respected and beloved iconic hardcore band going glam?
I mean, it does sound like the type of thing that would make people who care about this very angry.
Yes, that is correct. You are correct. I mean, I don't think it's at all surprising, considering the not terribly forgiving nature of hardcore audiences, that the album and subsequent tour were a complete and utter fucking disaster for the band, and that they disbanded soon after that tour ended. Glam metal, John, it is perhaps a more powerful force for good or evil than any of us could possibly have imagined, no?
I mean, it is unfortunate that it went so shittily that they had to disband. That's not good.
Oof. Well, what are you going to do? People don't like it when you break out of your mold. Whether it's a good breakout or a bad breakout, I don't think it matters.
Yeah, change is bad. Don't change. Everyone stay exactly the same.
Yeah, that's why all of our episodes are basically indistinguishable from one to the next. Just the same shit.
Look, I have genuinely no idea what you're doing, but I'm pretty sure you could cut and splice my comments from any given episode, and they're probably going to work in any other given episode.
That's literally how I put together final edits. I just have this file I call John Bullshit, and I just plug it in.
I actually haven't been at a recording session in 2 years. We knocked out all of my stuff in that first season.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time I make this announcement official. John is dead. John died, but we have kept him alive through a bank of sounds he recorded from his deathbed. Thanks, John. Thanks for all the memories.
And back to you, Eric.
And... if that example wasn't weird enough, just 2 short years later, in September of 1988, that most majestic, beloved Swiss extreme metal institution, the all-powerful Celtic Frost, also decided to attempt their own explorations of the glam idiom. Cold Lake, John. Cold Lake. Our whole listening audience just went twitchy with goose pimples. Is this perhaps the very most universally hated album by one of the most respected bands ever? I don't know. I think Metallica and Lou Reed might have a couple of things to say about that. Lulu. Cough, cough, Lulu. But Cold Lake is most certainly in that discussion. Now, in fairness to Celtic Frost, Cold Lake is really just Tom G. Warrior and a bunch of new dudes working under the name Celtic Frost. Still, much as I love glam metal and much as I worship Celtic Frost, it's pretty hard to appreciate the album other than as a historical oddity. A musty, crusty artifact from a time back when glam truly ruled the world. Tom G. Warrior agrees that it is a moldering pile of shit, and Cold Lake is out of print and impossible to find streaming other than on YouTube. That said, all good heavy metal scholars should at least take a listen. John, you're a good heavy metal scholar. Will you be investigating Grave New World and or Cold Lake?
I refuse to accept that title, and I will not be listening to either of those albums.
Is that because you're dead?
Next.
Regardless, this is an important reminder for all. In the second half of the 1980s, the glam ethos was so powerfully popular and magnetic that a couple of the most ruggedly idiosyncratic and brilliant groups in the history of heavy music, fucking Discharge and Celtic Frost, were once lured by its siren song. Glam really was, for a short while, at the beating heart of the heavy metal universe. John, can you feel it? Do you at last understand?
Dan.
Understand what? No one is arguing that this was popular.
Oh. Okay.
We all know this was popular. We just think it wasn't good.
Oh. So I haven't really swayed you in any meaningful way.
No.
Okay. We need to move this thing along. So what's next, Palomine?
Category number 4. The further adventures of first wave glam bands during the second wave. I think that could have been clunkier.
but it was good, right? You liked it?
Remains to be seen.
All right. It is time to look in on what our old friends from the first wave of Sunset Strip glam bands were up to during these halcyon days of wave numero dos. In order to keep things relatively manageable, we're only going to briefly discuss the 6 second wave bands we featured on our storied season number 2 episode, A Brief History of Glam Metal Part 2, The First Wave of Los Angeles Glam Metal, parentheses, 1981 through 85. That would be Motley Crue, Dokken, Wasp, Great White, Striper, and Rat. John, I see that you have your head cradled in your hands and are possibly in tears. Are you looking forward to catching up with some of our old buddies?
It's just you and the words brief with 6 bands. This is going to hurt. I just know it's going to hurt.
You got this. Okay, how's about this? Why don't we tag team this category and blow through this fabulous assortment of great bands and albums expeditiously? How does that sound?
Let's go.
Are you feeling at all uneasy about this idea of us both tag-teaming and blowing an assortment of great bands? Or is that just my own sexual insecurities peeping through?
That was fully all on you until you brought it up.
Alrighty then. Let us begin with a first wave glam metal band who were perfectly situated to take advantage of this magical time. Yes, John, it's time to return to discussion of one of the few bands upon which you and I see eye to eye, God's very most favorite glam metal band, the band which once caused you and I to look across a crowded room, stare deeply into each other's eyes, and to fall truly, deeply, and madly in love. Ladies and germs, I'm talking about everyone's favorite Christian glam metalhead, Striper. John, we love Striper, right?
I mean, yet again, I am chagrined to say that the Striper song on the playlist was my favorite song on the playlist.
I love it. This Striper thing we have between us is really my favorite legacy of the entire Heavy Metal 101 podcast. It really is. I want you to know that. On October 24th of 1986, Striper released their second full-length album, the platinum smash, To Hell with the Devil. Now, John, I could not resist chasing that magnificent high once more and included a Striper track on your playlist. What did you think of the title track, To Hell with the Devil?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good song. It's a good song.
Right? It's catchy.
Yeah.
Pretty rocking. It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well played. Good songwriting.
Yeah.
You're a Striper fan. It's okay. I feel you. Imagine what my Jewish parents must think about my adoration for Striper.
I just, there's such a cognitive dissonance for me between their messaging and my enjoyment of their music.
What, you think that's any less true of me?
No, I just, normally I don't encounter these types of challenges. Normally my brain just goes, no, I don't like that.
Striper is able to penetrate the thickest of aesthetic hides. Look, I fucking love Striper. I don't obviously give too much of a fuck about this whole God thing, but if religion did one good thing ever, it was providing us with this wonderful, wonderful band. Chef's kiss, baby. I'd love to linger on the glory that is Striper, but I'll just passingly mention that the direct follow-up to Hell with the Devil, 1988's In God We Trust, it has a few really fabulous songs on it, but it generally leans just a bit too hard into the poppier, sappier, suckier side of Striper's oeuvre, and I don't think it's held up nearly as well as their prior two albums. But John, we're forgiving blokes, no? We still love us some Striper, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Striper! Well, they were the big winners of the inaugural John McKeever Memorial Best First Wave Glam Metal Band Award back when we last focused on said bands. John was also at least reasonably positive about Dokken. Ish. John, do you remember rocking with Dokken?
Vaguely.
I mean, I think your comments were something to the effect of it wasn't as good as you thought it was going to be.
Hey, that sounds like a positive me.
It wasn't negative. It wasn't explicitly negative. Look, everyone sort of kind of a little bit loves rockin' with Dokken. The ever dysfunctional Dokken, they really only managed to release just one album during Glam's most storied period, the excellent Back for the Attack from 1987. But it really was a very good album, and certainly their biggest popular hit, attaining platinum status and peaking at an impressive number 13 on the Billboard charts. It also included arguably the single greatest heavy metal theme song to a horror movie of all time, Dream Warriors.
Fuck the prime time, bitch!
From the wonderful third installment of the Nightmare on Elm Street film franchise. John, are you a Nightmare on Elm Street fan?
Nope.
Have you seen those movies?
Nope.
Jesus Christ.
You know I don't like horror.
Moving on! John, for the sake of expediency, how's about you fill us in on the remaining first wave glam bands under consideration, HM101 montage style? I would really enjoy that.
Of course, Eric, it would be my absolute pleasure. Wasp had a bit of a false second wave start in 1986, releasing arguably the weakest of their classic albums, Inside the Electric Circus. Singer Blackie Lawless has referred to it as a tired record by a tired band. However, Wasp recovered nicely with their highest charting album of the decade, 1989's The Headless Children, which peaked at number 48 in the US and featured an iconic cover of The Who song, The Real Me.
Now that's a good one. Wasp never quite managed to achieve the superstar status of many of their peers, but what about Great White, John? I'd posit that their material, released during the first wave of glam, was fairly inauspicious when compared with that of the other bands under discussion. But however did they fare during the second wave?
Why, Eric, I'm so glad you asked. While the first two Great White albums passed relatively unnoticed, peaking at numbers 144 and 123 respectively on the Billboard Top 200, their breakthrough came in 1987 with the release of Once Bitten, which included the hit single Rock Me, and peaked at a considerably more impressive number 23 in the US and achieved platinum certification.
I have a fun fact. The first time I ever heard Once Bitten as a young lad was when I checked the CD out of my local library. Viva the public library system. Okay, please continue.
We love a good public library.
We do, absolutely.
Even greater popular success lay ahead with the 1989 release of Twice Shy, which included the massive hit Once Bitten, Twice Shy, a cover of a song by the English glam rocker Ian Hunter.
You see what they did with the title, John? An album called Once Bitten. An album called Twice Shy. A single called Once Bitten, Twice Shy. It's all pretty crafty, no? Great White, we're playing the long game on that one.
That's some remarkable forethought for people who generally involve themselves in this genre of music.
Yes, I agree. Bunch of fucking morons.
Well, fuckers or not, it did earn them a double platinum certification, Grammy nomination, and top 40 album.
And how's about those delightful rodents from Rat? Whatever were they up to?
Following their 1984 debut, Rat suffered slowly but surely from an unfortunate phenomenon, the law of diminishing returns. Their very solid 1985 release, Invasion of Your Privacy, followed a template which was remarkably similar to that of the debut. It was followed by the fairly solid 1986 album, Dancing Undercover, which Eric would like to point out features the excellent track Body Talk.
Body Talk!
Which also more or less followed the very same template. Again, while Invasion had peaked at number 7 on US charts, Dancing, by contrast, peaked only at number 26, and it was clear that Rat were being commercially and artistically overtaken by the younger, sexier bands of glam's second wave.
And yet to come was 1988's Reach for the Sky, which featured some genuinely questionable tunes like Way Cool Junior or the dreaded I Want a Woman.
Yikes!
Ah, Rat. Still a great band, gosh dang it. Okay, John, we've got just one more band for this segment, but I know this one might be a bit tricksy for you. Do you have sufficient gumption to tell us about what Motley Crue were up to during this period?
As long as I don't have to listen to them, Eric, I am more than happy to tell you all about them. That's the first line you've written for me that genuinely felt like my voice.
I know, wasn't that? I thought you would appreciate that.
That's good. That's good. That's good writing there, buddy.
Good, good. I appreciate the acknowledgement. Look, I can live with that. It's a deal. All right. This is the big one. Make me proud.
It could well be argued that Motley Crue... Thank you for putting in the umlauts this time.
Read it like a normal person.
It could well be argued that Motley Crue single-handedly kicked off the second wave of glam metal with their state-of-the-art glam release from June 21st, 1985, Theater of Pain. This was the band's most accessible album to date, and in hitting number 6 on the Billboard charts and eventually being certified quadruple platinum, it was proof of concept for the continuing viability of glam as a massively popular genre moving into the second half of the 1980s.
And this, despite the fact that the album fucking sucks. Sorry, just saying. Not great. Not great.
That's Eric saying
that. Yes, terrible. Terrible album.
It was during the tour for Theater of Pain, while the band was playing in London, that bassist Nikki Sixx first nearly died of a heroin overdose. Yes, this was just the first time. That's right, kids, don't do drugs. Or perhaps your unconscious body might also someday be found in a London dumpster. Sixx survived the incident, however, and the band went on to release their massively successful fourth album, Girls, Girls, Girls.
Also sucks!
On May 15th, 1987. And in December of that same year, Sixx suffered yet another heroin overdose. He was officially declared dead, but was eventually revived, as was soon to be musically documented in the Motley Crue hit, Kickstart My Heart. At this point, the entire band entered rehab and then recorded their sober album, Dr. Feelgood.
Which fucking also sucks. God damn it.
They did that in Vancouver with the legendary Bob Rock at the helm. It became a number one hit, further securing Motley Crue's status as one of the very most significant bands of the era, regardless of the consistently unfucking believably awful singing of Vince Neil, which, along with the greatness of Stryper, is one of the few things in this world upon which Eric and I agree.
Amen, sister. If we wanted to tie this whole segment into a nice neat bow, we might mention the cultural pinnacle of 1980s glam metal that was the legendary Moscow Music Peace Festival, which occurred on August 12th through 13th of 1989 and featured Bon Jovi, Ozzy, Motley Crue, The Scorpions, Soviet Russia's very own glam metal band, Gorky Park, and two fantastic second wave bands we'll be discussing shortly, Cinderella and Skid Row. John, can you even fucking imagine the glory of this monumental celebration of Glasnost and American sleaze rock?
There's another cognitive dissonance here of the idea of a Moscow Music Peace Festival featuring glam metal.
Yeah, it's a different world. Well, John, I don't have to imagine what the beautiful celebration of American glam metal and Soviet glasnost was like, because the concerts were broadcast on MTV, and I watched the entire magnificent event in a state of delirious euphoria back in the day. It was beautiful, my friend. Just beautiful. In fact, I think it's probably fair to say that glam metal single-handedly ended the Cold War. All right. We need to get our asses into gear, out with the old, and in with the new. Let's meet a whole new slate of second-wave glam metal characters. Won't that be swell?
I guess we'll find out.
This is so fucking swell. John, speak it into being.
Category number 5, glam metal, the next generation.
Now, this is the collection of bands that just so happened to be coming onto the scene at the very same time as a metal-hungry young lad named Eric. So you can probably imagine that I feel a certain attachment to this particular collection of artists. These are my dudes. Let's just begin with arguably the most significant of the glam bands that hit the scene during the second wave, a band which gets a lot of shit from a lot of people, but whose contribution to the idiom truly was monumental. John, are you ready to talk about some motherfucking Poison?
Yeah, baby!
I guess so.
Big John, John, you're not a big Poison fan, are you?
No, all three forms of Poison that I had to interact with for this playlist were not appealing to me.
That Alice Cooper song is fucking amazing. You're an idiot. Actually, I really like both those Poison songs, too. You are an idiot. Jesus. I, by contrast, was a fucking huge Poison fan. Their posters festooned the walls of my childhood bedroom. And, while I'll confess that some of their music has lost its luster in the years since I've become a grown-up and had the opportunity to reevaluate many of my youthful musical dalliances, I usually still do love Poison's debut, which I think is a true masterpiece of the high glam idiom. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. This is an important subject, and I'm going to give it its just desserts via the application of my best gruff narrator, voiceover style. You ready for this, JJ?
JJ?
JJ. John John.
Sure.
John Jakeever.
That was worse. Keep going. What's your third take?
Jerky John.
That's my radio disc jockey name.
Oh, I like it. Yeah, that's good. Okay.
Well, on the surface, Poison might seem like the very Sunset Strippiest of the Sunset Strip bands. In actuality, the band that would become Poison formed in 1983 in the not-so-glamorous Pennsylvania borough of Mechanicsburg. A band which was first known as Paris was founded by vocalist Brett Michaels, drummer Ricky Rocket, and guitarist Matt Smith. Towards the end of 1983, the band, now including bassist Bobby Dahl and renamed Poison, relocated to sunny Southern California, where they would struggle in the wannabe glam trenches of the Sunset Strip until the departure of guitarist Smith in 1985. During the process of auditioning for his replacement, the final choice came down to a brash, Brooklyn-born fellow working under the nom de plume C.C. DeVille, and a soulful shredder born Saul Hudson, but who listeners, and John, will likely know better by his chosen mononym, Slash.
John, does it surprise you that the legendary future Guns N' Roses Axemaster Slash quite nearly became a member of Poison in 1985?
Well, I didn't know that. Surprise is too strong an emotion for me to feel about this band.
All right. In similarly fun news, DeVille, who of course went on to win the gig with Poison, had only just recently turned down an offer to join up with beloved HM101 favorite Striper. Holy glam metal incestuousness, Batman. Okay, back to the narrative, but maybe just a bit less portentously. Poison was eventually signed to Enigma Records and released their iconic debut, Look What the Cat Dragged In, on May 23rd, 1986. I've already confessed my undying love for this album. John, I know the answer to this, but what did you think of the first massive hit single, which I included on your playlist, the great Talk Dirty to Me?
It's just, like, again, as I said, none of these songs are bad. They just, like, they're very formulaic. The sound doesn't sound special. And they're just, it's very poppy.
It's very poppy.
It doesn't speak to me in any sort of an artistically moving way.
You weren't moved by Talk Dirty to Me?
I was not moved.
Didn't make you want to talk dirty to someone you love?
No.
I like every song on this album, but my very, very, very favorite is the title track, which I think gets at the grittier, more punk-infused side of the glam metal movement that a lot of people are inclined to forget about. But not us, John. Not us. We're going to actually take a listening break here to give the people an oral peek into that rawer, sexier, hungrier side of second wave glam. If you have ever utterly dismissed Poison as a bunch of poppy poser pretty boys, or if you just want to rock out to a great second wave glam tune, pause the podcast, click on the link in the show notes, and take a listen to the title track of the debut album, Look What the Cat Dragged In. Now, John, I know that you hate all the things that bring even a modicum of joy to the people. This is well established.
Yes.
But isn't that a delightful fucking song?
Well, so let me answer your question with a question, Eric. Mm-hmm. Two parts. Can something be delightful and gritty? And part two, can you please define what the hell is supposed to be gritty about that song?
Oh, it's got a great riff. Don't you think the riff is pretty gritty? And it's all sleazy. It's all about, you know, I went to bed too late. My poor head's still swimming from too much booze. I got a girl on the left of me, a girl on the right. I know damn well I slept with both last night. That's gritty. And probably true.
I just don't. Your definition of grit and my definition of grit are two very different definitions of grit.
Okay, here's what that song makes me think of. That song makes me think of the side of the glam metal, the non-glamorous side of the glam metal oeuvre, when these bands were young and broke and just dirty early 20s or late teenagers living in near destitution, in cockroach-infested apartments, barely scraping by.
What of the text that you just read to me even remotely implies the world that you're describing right now?
Oh my God. Look what the cat dragged in. Living my life, sin after sin. The night rolls up, and I do it again. Oh my God, my God. Look what the cat dragged in. Poison.
Is shit.
The album was famously recorded on something of a shoestring budget. $23,000. It's not a lot of money to record an album.
No, that is not.
But I think the rough production quality here is really what keeps this album fairly evergreen aesthetically. I think that. John respectfully disagrees. The songs are delectably poppy, but there's enough metal and even punk grit herein, in my estimation, such that it all still works. For me. Maybe not for everyone. Maybe not for John. Maybe not for some of our listeners who I piss off by doing these glam metal episodes. But that's okay. Regardless, it certainly did work for people back in the day, peaking at number 3 on the US charts and eventually certifying 3 times platinum. Of course, Poison, at least at this point, were quite literally the glammiest of the glam bands, and so when the eventual backlash did come, their legacy was pretty damn decimated. Anyhow, Poison were off and running and would be on to bigger, if not necessarily better things with their sophomore release, Open Up and Say, Ah. From 1988, which went 5 times platinum and scored the band their only number one single via the lovely ballad Every Rose Has Its Thorn, one of my karaoke staples. In fact, I hired my bar mitzvah band only based on the fact that that song was in their repertoire. So that says something. Another single from that album is a John favorite, Nothing But a Good Time, which, along with Every Rose Has Its Thorn, was prominently featured in HM101's least favorite musical of all time, Rock of Ages. John, how does it feel today to be excavating some of the source material from that special, special show?
Not great.
Now, maybe next time you watch it, you'll have more of an appreciation, understanding the grit and the underlying anti-glamour below the glossy surface of Poison's visual and oral aesthetic.
I cannot overstate how much I hope that I never have to see Rock of Ages with my own two eyes.
Respect. Now, other than one little group to be named shortly, Poison really were probably the biggest and most important of these new glam bands that emerged in the second wave. But there is another band that was quite nearly as big, and I'd absolutely love it if you could tell us all about them. John, it's Cinderella time. read us a nice fairy tale, would ya?
Cinderella isn't just that famous folk tale and eventual classic Disney film, which was first written down by the Italian author Gian Battista Basile in 1634. No, sir. It was also, for our purposes, more importantly, a Pennsylvania-based glam metal band originally formed in 1983 by singer and guitarist Tom Kiefer and bassist Eric Brittingham. It was via the intervention of a fairy godmother named John Bon Jovi that the band was, in 1985, signed to a record deal with Mercury/Polygram. The lineup that recorded their legendary 1986 debut album, Night Songs, consisted of Kiefer, Brittingham, as well as...
Brittingham!
Whatever.
Kiefer and Brittingham!
Their music sucks. As well as dearly departed guitarist Jeff Labar.
Your music sucks.
The band entered the studio with drummer...
Jim Dernick.
Dernick?
I think so. Nobody knows who this guy is. So, well, let's go with Dernick.
Jim Dernick. D-R-N-E-C?
Yeah.
Wow. But he was soon fired from the band for being unable to...
Wait, just read the Dernick.
I said that. How many times do we need to say Dernick?
Dernick.
Jim Dernick was the drummer, but he was soon fired from the band for being unable to successfully lay down his drum tracks because he sucked and now he's not famous.
Poor Jim.
Session drummer. Jim is going to turn out to be one of our deepest followers and listeners.
He's probably a super fan.
Yeah, this is awful. Hey, Jim, tell us how to pronounce your last name.
Yeah, please. We want to be correct. Historical accuracy is very important to us.
Just like being able to lay down a drum track.
Oh, Dernick.
Session drummer Jody Cortez performed on the album, with classic lineup drummer Fred Curry joining up with the band after the recording sessions were complete. In what will become a familiar pattern for bands of this era, the up-tempo first single, Shake Me, didn't originally make much of an impact on the listening public. However, the second single, the power ballad, Nobody's Fool, was a massive hit, breaking the band big and eventually leading the album to a triple platinum certification. Cinderella also benefited from an opening slot touring with their mentors, Bon Jovi, which was a rather choice gig, with Bon Jovi then touring in support of their utterly massive Slippery When Wet album. In 1988, Cinderella released their second album, Long Cold Winter, which also commercially benefited from a hit ballad, Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone. This album provides an early example of a glam metal band seeking more credibility via a rootsier, blues-based approach, though it would be far from the last time that would happen. Long Cold Winter peaked at number 10 on the Billboard charts and, like its predecessor, eventually received triple platinum certification.
I think that Cinderella are one of those bands that a lot of people sometimes forget were utterly huge. John, had you ever previously heard of the band Cinderella prior to your stint here on HM101?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, apparently not a band with legs, which is a shame. Both of those first two albums were great. I wanted to give you a taste of that quirky, rootsy, glam thing, so I put Long Cold Winter's opening diptych of Bad Seamstress Blues and Fallen Apart at the Seams on your playlist. You like it?
It just sounds confused today.
You don't think that it would be the same synthesis of pop metal sensibilities and clearly culturally appropriated blues licks?
Well, I mean, it is definitely that. It is exactly that. It just, listening to it feels like two unrelated things that were mushed together. Even though, I understand the roots, I understand the origin, I understand the historical lineage that we've discussed, that just, this was not a good synthesis. It was hey, here's an opening blues riff, and then here's a pop song.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's maybe more than just a bit of musical tourism on display, but they were still a great band. Great. But fuck me. The hour grows late, and there's still much to do. We need to get moving. In order to launch us towards our grand finale, I think that an assortment of brief, colorful vignettes will be a perfect approach for detailing the life and times of the best of the other glam metal artists who emerged at this time. Don't you?
Brief is great.
Great. Let's alternate silky, smooth, baritone deliveries. I go first. Vignette powers, go!
White Lion.
White Lion was founded in New York City in 1983 by an American virtuoso guitarist, Vito Bratta, and the Danish singer, Mike Tramp. Their actual not-so-well-known debut, Fight to Survive, was originally released only in Japan, though it did eventually get a US release in June of 1986. However, it was their sophomore album, Pride, released on June 22, 1987, that truly broke the band, including two top 10 singles, Wait and the acoustic ballad When the Children Cry. Pride went on to sell 2 million copies. Their 1989 follow-up, Big Game, peaked at number 19 on the Billboard charts and might be particularly noted for its politically engaged songs, something quite unusual in glam metal circles. These included the singles Little Fighter, about the sinking of the Greenpeace boat Rainbow Warrior, and the anti-apartheid song Cry for Freedom.
Warrant.
Police, put your hands up.
Warrant was originally founded in Hollywood in 1984, though the band's significant period truly began in 1987 when singer Janie Lane and drummer Stephen Sweet, previously of the band Plain Jane, as well as guitarist Joey Allen, joined up with Warrant guitarist Eric Turner and bassist Jerry Dixon to form the band's classic lineup. Janie Lane was always the band's MVP, composing all of the music and lyrics for their 1989 hit debut album, Dirty Rotten Filthy Stinkin' Rich,
which included the Rock of Ages approved banger, the power ballad, Heaven. So there's that!
Skid Row.
Ugh! Fuck, fuck, fucky fuck! This band deserves a hell of a lot more than a fucking vignette. To my mind, Skid Row were the best of the second wave glam metal bands. Other than the Mighty Guns N' Roses. In fact, I'd argue that their sophomore album, 1991's Slave to the Grind, is the great artistic masterpiece of the glam metal oeuvre, or possibly its second greatest masterpiece. But alas, we aren't here to talk about that, are we? No, we're not. So more on Skid Row eventually, but for now, just a really quick introduction. The whole of the instrumental portion of their classic lineup came together in Toms River, NJ in 1986. Guitarists Dave the Snake Sabo and Scotty Hill, bassist Rachel Boland, and drummer Rob Afuso. Sabo had grown up with a young lad named John Bon Jovi, and with his always helpful assistance, the band secured the attentions of Bon Jovi manager and world-renowned cocaine dealer Doc McGee. In 1987, Skid Row scored a major coup, hiring a then 18-year-old virtuoso vocalist who was born Sebastian Philip Birk, but who works under the delightful nom de plume, Sebastian Bach. He was also, incidentally, the godson of my high school health teacher. Anyhow, with a mix of extraordinary talent and extraordinary patronage, the table was set for a major label debut with Atlantic Records and an eponymous debut album, which was released on January 24th, 1989. This was a pretty amazing debut, and it managed to go 5 times platinum. So, yowza. Seriously, few glam metal albums hold up as well as the first two Skid Row albums have held up. Everyone, go and listen to those albums. Now! Well, wait!
Faster Pussycat and LA Guns.
Wait! I know it's your turn. Sorry for yet another interruption, but before John provides us with our final double vignette, I have a broad contextual note to interject. In retrospect, the second wave emergence of a grimier collection of glam bands, like LA Guns and Faster Pussycat, for instance, can be understood as the beginnings of an all-important glam subgenre, which is sometimes known as dirty glam metal. Okay then, dirty glam metal. John, tell us about it, stud.
Both Faster Pussycat and LA Guns emerged from the same legendary glam metal scene in Los Angeles, California, which had birthed glam's first wave. Faster Pussycat was founded by local scenester and future co-owner of the Sunset Strip Club, the Cat House, Tamey Down, in 1985. The band released their rather sleazy and unpolished eponymous debut in 1987 and eventually managed to achieve their first and only gold certification via their bluesy sophomore album, 1989's Wake Me When It's Over, which vaunted to success on the strength of a hit ballad, House of Pain. LA Guns, meanwhile, share not just a single word, but actual DNA with Guns N' Roses, originally founded by guitarist Tracy Guns in 1983. By 1985, LA Guns had merged with another Los Angeles band, Hollywood Rose, which at the time featured a singer named Axl Rose and a guitarist named Izzy Stradlin. The resultant band was appropriately renamed Guns N' Roses. Guitarist Guns left relatively soon thereafter and reformed LA Guns, eventually bringing in British singer Phil Lewis, formerly of the influential proto-glam metal band Girl. LA Guns released an excellent self-titled debut in 1988 and the more commercially successful sophomore release 1989's Cocked and Loaded, which, like many a glam album before and after, rose to particular public prominence based on the success of yet another hit ballad, The Ballad of Jane. End of second wave glam metal vignettes.
What a delightful, zigzaggy journey through second wave glam metal history that was. John, did you have a good time or what?
Sure.
Yeah. Of course, we're all here for the main event, aren't we? When Heavy Metal 101 stops being polite and starts getting real. That's right. It's time to talk GNFNR. John, what are your thoughts on the great American musical institution that is, was, and always shall be Guns N' Roses?
Well, this is one of those bands that I did actually know before this show.
You like them, right?
I like some of their songs, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you have to understand, I come from the era of music. By the time where I was making musical decisions for myself, we didn't buy albums.
Yeah.
We bought tracks. So you made me listen to, am I getting ahead of things?
No, you can lay it out there.
You made me listen to all of Appetite for Destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew like the big hits from Appetite for Destruction because I purchased those tracks independently because they were songs I liked.
So you liked some famous Guns N' Roses songs coming into this?
Correct.
Okay, that's nice. So you're something of a fan. Are you aware of much of the history behind this fine ensemble?
No.
Surprise, surprise. But that, my friend, is why we're here. So we've already discussed a bit of their origin story with the melding of two bands, LA Guns and Hollywood Rose, in Los Angeles. The complete lineup at that time consisted of Axl Rose, Izzy Stradlin, and Tracy Guns, as well as drummer Rob Gardner and a Danish bassist named Ole Beich, who, fun fact, was briefly a member of Satan's house band Merciful Fate. Beich was only in GNR for a vanishingly brief time and was replaced by classic lineup bassist Duff McKagan after just two rehearsals. When Tracy Guns left, he was replaced by a fellow who had formerly played in Hollywood Rose and who had quite nearly become a member of Poison. This fine lad was, of course, our beloved buddy Slash. Everybody loves Slash. Hell of a guitarist. Funny Instagram poster. Ooh, a fun Slash fact. Were you aware that Slash was born in London?
I was not.
Indeed. He moved to the U.S. at the tender age of 6, an international man of mystery to boot. Drummer Gardner eventually quit the band and was replaced by yet another former member of Hollywood Rose, Steven Adler. And so, by the summer of 1985, the classic lineup of Guns N' Roses was fully assembled. John, please read the official roll into the record using appropriately reverential tones.
Axl Rose, lead vocals. Slash, lead guitar. Izzy Stradlin, rhythm guitar. Duff McKagan, bass. Steven Adler, drums.
Guns N' Roses were signed to Geffen Records in March of 1986, and their first release was a four-song faux live EP, Live! Like a Suicide, a.k.a. Live Like a Suicide, in December of that same year. Although the original EP was a very limited release, most fans will be familiar with this material as the first side of the 1988 album GNR Lies. John, are you familiar with that bad boy?
Nope.
It's a great album, but with a couple of very unfortunate lyrics. Very, very unfortunate. Anyhow, the original EP consisted of four studio tracks, two originals, and covers of tunes by Rose Tattoo and Aerosmith, with crowd noise overdubbed on top to make it appear to be a live recording. Fun! I think it would be well worth taking a short listening break to remind ourselves of what the 10,000 people who originally purchased this EP heard as their first recorded taste of this soon-to-be legendary band. let's all check out the opening track from Live Like a Suicide, Reckless Life, which was penned by Rose Stradlin and former Hollywood Rose guitarist Chris Weber. You all know the drill. Pause the podcast, click the link in the show notes, and we'll see you on the other side. Great and wondrous John, what did you make of this early slab OG and F and R?
That was fine.
Yeah, that's fair. I think the material on Live Like a Suicide is all solid, but generally unspectacular. It's all right.
Yeah.
You and I think, are in agreement here. It didn't bowl you over?
No.
Wasn't like hearing Welcome to the Jungle for the first time?
It was not.
Yeah. In candor, I really don't think the EP provides all that much in the way of a preview of the glories that were soon to follow, but, you know, it's a perfectly fine little historical musical artifact. Now, before we get to those very glories, we've a couple more preliminaries to deal with. We've already discussed Slash a wee bit, but I think a few moments spent on each of the other members of the classic lineup might be worth our while. First off, let's deal with the elephant in the room, one William Bruce Rose Jr., a.k.a. W. Axl Rose, a.k.a. William Bruce Bailey, a.k.a. Bill Bailey, a.k.a. Axl Rose. You get all that?
I'm going to forget in 5 minutes anyway.
Now, I have a fun fact I actually only learned like a year or two ago from, of all sources, a formal academic paper written about heavy metal. John, were you aware that Axl Rose is an anagram for oral sex?
No. I mean, I can see that now. I can read that.
I know. Yeah. I think we could all see it in theory. It was hiding in plain sight.
You telling me this guy's a fucking nerd? Because the only people who like anagrams are fucking nerds.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. Although he became something maybe else when he got famous, I think that Axl was a bit of a nerdy weirdo in the early days. I think that's probably accurate. Unfortunately, he also has a legacy of racism, homophobia, violence, and generalized dickishness to live down.
Yikes.
But, yeah, there can be no question that, for better and worse, Axl Rose is probably the single most important member of Guns N' Roses.
You telling me we're about to spend the rest of this podcast talking about a horrible person?
No. A horrible person's band.
Great. Love that for us.
He was born in Lafayette, Indiana. He relocated to sunny Los Angeles in 1982, where he eventually founded the band Hollywood Rose. Next up is Hollywood Rose's co-founder, Izzy Stradlin, who was born Jeffrey Dean Isbell, and who also grew up, along with Axl, in Lafayette. And I've got a fun fact about Izzy. Although he graduated with a not-so-impressive D average, Stradlin is the only member of the classic lineup who actually does have a high school diploma. So, go Izzy! we're proud of you.
Yikes.
And then there's bassist Michael Andrew McKagan, a.k.a. Duff, who grew up in Seattle, Washington, and spent his formative years playing drums, guitar, or bass in an assortment of punk bands, including one tastefully called The Farts.
Nice. With a Z. That's good.
With a Z, yes. Last up is drummer Steven Adler, who was born Michael Coletti and hailed from snowy Cleveland, OH, home of my alma mater, the Cleveland Institute of Music. Now, most importantly, Steven's mother was Jewish, which according to Orthodox tradition makes Steven a fellow Jew. Welcome to the tribe, Stevie. L'chaim. Oh, and he eventually became a fucking huge heroin addict, which led to him being fired by the band in 1990. So that's GNR, the human beings. John, you feel like you now know these dudes just a little bit better.
I do, and I don't feel great about that.
I could see that. I really could. Now look, my take is that Appetite for Destruction is the single greatest album to emerge out of the glam metal subgenre. So let's actually discuss this gosh dang album. John, because you're such a fan, I'm going to give you the first stab at this. Please lovingly tell us the story of one of the great artistic achievements in all of heavy metal, and arguably the single greatest debut album of all time.
An assortment of producers were considered for the album that would become Appetite for Destruction, including Spencer Proffer, Manny Charlton, Paul Stanley, Mutt Lang, and Tom Werman. But eventually, Mike Klink, who had only previously produced two albums, was selected. Recording began in January of 1987 at Rumbo Recorders in Canoga Park, and was finished on June 27th. The album cost $365,000 to make, an unusually high budget for a debut. But as it went on to sell 30 million copies worldwide, it would seem that this was a wise investment. The tracks that made it onto Appetite for Destruction have a variety of different origin stories and/or fun facts attached to them, and as such, we have created a brief track-by-track discourse for your listening pleasure.
All right, let's take this in album order. Rose composed the lyrics to Welcome to the Jungle while visiting a friend in Seattle, and the band collectively assembled the music in approximately 3 hours, borrowing the song's breakdown from a tune McKagan had previously written for one of his formative punk bands. This was the band's first U.S. single, released on September 28, 1987.
McKagan brought It's So Easy to the band, which was co-written with his neighbor guitarist West Arkeen. This was technically the band's very first single, co-released in the UK along with Mr. Brownstone on June 15th of 1987, over a month before the album came out.
A fun story about Night Train is that its pre-chorus was originally its chorus until Axl Rose played the song for Paul Stanley, Swoon, who heard the demo and made the brilliant suggestion to expand the material by turning the chorus into a pre-chorus and adding a new chorus. Yay, Paul Stanley!
Out to Get Me was written about Axl Rose's juvenile delinquency back in Indiana. That said, apparently Axl was fucking innocent, so that's good.
Mr. Brownstone was written about the band's troubles with heroin and was a co-write by Slash and Stradlin. The lyrics were originally written onto the back of a grocery bag.
Paradise City closes the G side of the album and was the band's third single released in the US. It was composed collectively by the band in the back of a rental van as they were driving home from a gig. Slash came up with the line, "Where the grass is green and the girls are pretty," but preferred to alternate versions, "Where the girls are fat and they've got big titties." Fortunately for all of us, the band outvoted him and stuck with the first version.
We flip the cassette over, and My Michelle opens the R side via its slinky, sinister, clean guitar introduction. Was written for a former girlfriend of Slash's and friend of the band, Michelle Young, who had expressed a desire to have a song written about her. Apparently the lyrics were a bit too ruthlessly honest about Michelle's life, which made the band nervous. But good news, she loved the song and eventually got off of drugs and got her shit together. So all's well that ends well with Michelle.
Think About You is an Izzy Stradlin joint, and he plays lead guitar on the track.
Also, tell me this isn't obviously a total fucking glam metal song. But I digress. Sweet Child of Mine was the band's second US single, released on June 21st, 1988, and it made them the biggest band in all the land. This was GNR's only number one hit song. The now legendary introductory riff started off as a joke with Slash just fucking around with what he considered to be a goofy circus tune during a jam session. Silly Slash. Axl wrote the lyrics for his then girlfriend, Erin Everly. How kissy squishy of him.
You're crazy. Is about one of those girls who wants to have sex just, like, all the fucking time. This sort of thing, obviously, is a huge problem for everyone on Heavy Metal 101 podcasting team, and we can relate to Axl. The struggle is real.
Anything Goes was originally a Hollywood Rose song and included a writing credit for former Hollywood Rose guitarist Christopher Weber. It's also a song on this album that I pretty much always forget exists.
Rocket Queen had been started as a song for Slash, McKagan, and Adler's previous band, Road Crew. Most fascinatingly, this track includes the sounds of Axl Rose having sex with a groupie named Adriana, who was kind of, sort of, Steven Adler's girlfriend, in the recording studio.
The anecdote is further evidence of Axl's utter awfulness. Unsurprisingly, all of this horrified Adler. It also led to years of drug and alcohol abuse for poor Adriana because, quote, "I had this extreme guilt and shame and stuff." So, Axl equals fucking awful human being. I mean, it's an incredible closing track, but that's kind of a lot, right?
Yeah, that's real shitty.
Yeah, yeah.
It's what you call real shitty behavior right there.
Good work, team. That's Appetite for Destruction in a nutshell. I am not including any assigned listening for this album, because if you haven't listened to it, your assignment is simply to rectify that immediately. I might here point out that as huge as this album was at the time, and beloved as it still is nearly 30 years later, in those days, Appetite wasn't much of a critical darling. But we've established nothing if not that critics are fucking stupid, so who cares? John, do you care?
Not about critics, no.
Me neither. There are all sorts of behind-the-music type stories that Mike could be told about GNR around this time. Maybe someday we'll do that, but for now, I'll just note that before becoming riot-inducing headliners, GNR opened for bands including Motley Crue, Alice Cooper, Aerosmith, and Iron Maiden, touring in support of Appetite. GNR went on to release the Lies album on November 29, 1988, which combined the Live Like a Suicide EP as its first side, along with four acoustic songs, including the massive hit Patience and the incredibly offensive One in a Million as the second side. Appetite had made it to number one on the Billboard charts, and Lies managed a still pretty impressive number two, eventually going five times platinum. And that's all I've got to say about that. John, we talked about Guns N' Roses. Wasn't that nice?
No. I mean, basically what I learned is that this Axl fellow is a real shithead, and then we had to talk about him for 30 more minutes.
You've learned the truth, and the truth is never a bad thing. Look, I think this was a real good day, spent amongst a whole bunch of really fun bands. But now we must depart. Should we close by checking back in on our super weird opening skit from the Pennsylvania nightclub? Or should we just tell the nice people how they can reach us and get the fuck out of Dodge?
Let's go with the latter.
Okay then. Why don't you do that?
As always, we would love to hear from you. You can reach out to the Heavy Metal 101 podcast anytime, either via email, voicemail, or social media. Every one of those links can be found in the show notes, so click away and say hello.
Indeed. It always puts a big old smile on our faces when people reach out. Also, if you haven't done so, please do consider writing us a nice review and or clicking on that there fifth star to help let other people know how very much fun we all have here at HM101. Anything you can do to get the word out is always so very appreciated. John, we're done with the rise of glam metal. Now all that we've got to look forward to is the precipitous fall. Darkest tragedy and deepest despair await us. Won't that be a joy to explore?
You're telling me we have to talk about the part where this music gets bad?
Oh, we sure do, mon ami.
Oy, boy.
It's gonna be a hell of a ride, my friends.